Nerd Appropriate presents exclusive coverage of the BioWare base, recorded live at PAX Prime 2013.
All right, welcome to the Rated NA podcast for the website nerdappropriate.com. As you'll notice, this is not a numbered podcast. We're doing a whole special series for you.
Yeah, we're going to be bringing you a total of 12 different podcasts recorded live at the BioWare base this year's PAX Prime. So make sure to click subscribe and enjoy.
Marizin, as you can see from my name placard, and I'm the community manager for BioWare Edmonton in Montreal.
Sorry, that's a very fancy word for this piece
name
of
name placard?
For this cardboard. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Moving
sort of
on.
The tone of what
moving on,
is
as Mel Fleming
about.
Would say.
Okay. Moving on, Cam. Thank you.
And we're here to talk about the future of gaming. Chris Bain is here.
Who he is?
I'm going to let the panelists introduce themselves, starting with Mel Fleming.
Hi, I'm not Chris Bain.
Yay!
Chris Bain, do you want to be on the panel?
Yeah, you should. Come on up.
Where is he?
Chris Bain.
Come on.
Chris Bain, everyone. Woo! Yay!
And as a special guest, Chris Bain's Hangover.
I knew we'd get someone for the audience.
There you go.
Yay.
I'm Mike Laidlaw, also not Chris Bain. I'm the creative director for Dragon Age, and therefore I'm probably supposed to be thinking about the future more than I'm capable of doing right now.
Oh, crap, I never actually introduced myself.
Nah, it's cool.
You said your name.
No, well, Jessica said her name.
I'm a localization project manager. Go.
I'm Mark Darrow. I'm the executive producer for Dragon Age. I have in previous incarnations been Chris Bain several times. Also been a Bain Chris. It was a little weird.
Probably awesome.
Yeah, kind of awesome.
Oh, you, as Chris Bain, you have trouble regulating your own body temperature. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm Cameron Lee, producer of Dragon Age, and I guess I want to be Chris Bain.
Hugs.
I'm Jacques Lebrun, technical director for Dragon Age, and I hope to be reincarnated as Chris Bain.
This is mental.
Oh, God. I'm Sebastian.
Welcome to Monday, everybody.
I'm the lead combat designer for Dragon Age. I have no Chris Bain related joke.
But you're sitting next to Chris Bain.
I'm sitting next to Chris Bain.
That was fun.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm Chris Bain.
Hey!
I work in BizDev at the studio supporting these wonderful human beings who decided to torment me today.
We can turn anyone into a rock star.
Yeah. Quickly, Jess, ask a question.
Yeah.
So, on a previous panel, Matt Goldman talked about how the future of gaming was 3D printing. I would like to know, is the future of gaming some kind of crazy gimmick like 3D printing where you make an immersive experience and bring it from the virtual to the actual? Or do you think that the future of gaming, do you think that the future of gaming continues to be making great games?
Yes. That's objection leading the witness on that one.
Making great games never goes away. So
our goal is to make shit games now for the future.
But you can print them.
But you can print exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
I do think we're seeing a trend towards gaming expanding as a medium in terms of action that you take and its physicality in the world. So I don't think it's a gimmick. I don't think 3D printed fish that you then 3D print oven to 3D print your cooking is actually going to be the kind. Like, I think gimmicks fail. Gimmicks fail inherently because gimmicks, by their very nature, are not designed with users in mind. They're designed to kind of catch your imagination, and then they often fall flat.
Or but, if they succeed, they're no longer a gimmick.
Yeah. By nature, they stop being a gimmick.
That's the trick, because, you know, that gimmick of color on television
I know.
Was never going to catch on.
I wanted black or blacks. That's all I wanted.
Yes. Yeah. So it's hard to tell what is a gimmick and isn't a gimmick. I mean, sometimes it's pretty obvious. I've been to a lot of... I guess it's kind of stopped in the late 90s. There was a lot of companies trying to introduce smell.
I knew you were going there.
To gaming.
We looked at it for BG2 and realized how disgusting the cult of the unseeing eye was going to be.
Yeah.
It's a sewer.
But these days, like nug smell, that'd be pretty cool.
I bet nugs smell great though.
They probably smell like aerosol butterscotch cheese. Cookies.
Butterscotch cookies and lavender.
Yeah. Just moople.
The candy. Yeah.
Liliana's nug? No?
I think we ran out of that one.
I'm not a fan of gimmicks. You see too many of them fail. So yeah. I personally think the future of gaming is still going to be wicked games that you guys actually want to play. And then if there's interesting things that will come along, I'm thinking maybe 10 years from now. If there's interesting things that come along, I think it'll be a slight enhancement to the experience. There's Oculus Rift and stuff like that as well, which is an interesting route. I think that's got more chance of success than some other things.
I think that's starting... I mean, 5 years ago, I never would have said it because I mean, you were seeing 3D televisions falling flat on their faces. But the Oculus Rift might become a legitimate platform. It's certainly showing some good early promise.
Well, and the strength of the Rift is what we're seeing right now is we're seeing actual games that are good in first person and in that level of immersion. Because I think that the danger with any type of tech like that is like people immediately go, how are you going to put your heavily menu driven RPG on there? And we go, we're not. Because, oh my God, boop, 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 boop. I don't want to do that, right? It's just menus flying at you. We that doesn't mean BioWare would never do it, but in terms of Inquisition, it's not the right game for a Rift, right? It's inherently third person. So who am I, the invisible cameraman, huffing and puffing behind everybody? Well, that's anachronistic and therefore not allowed. So
romance scenes would be very interesting.
I guess. Yeah.
Well, I think when you look at the different interfaces over the last few years, you see, you know, Kinect was the first one kind of out. And there's always that journey as games get made of how is the interface going to fit with that play pattern? And sometimes it doesn't work. So I think there's going to be more failures than successes, but that's normal. When you look at Oculus, you look at the different interfaces. So it will evolve. It's just what play pattern will evolve, what type of game will make the most sense playing it, because there are some interesting, you know, types of games that you could see coming out for it. It's just, you know, there's going to be a lot of people trying to fit round things into square holes for a while.
I'm so glad we have Chris on the
panel. Yeah, someone who makes sense.
Yeah, I know.
To go to Jess's initial question, though, like, you know, games being more physical, I think that I don't know necessarily that games necessarily need a physical component, like a thing you touch or whatever, 3D printed, as it were. But definitely we're seeing a trend towards them coming with you. That sense of mm-hmm. persistence and permanence, whether it be, well, I mean, partly what we're doing with the Keep is like, cool, like, even at work I can be adjusting what my DA world's going to be. Yeah. A lot of games, you know, a lot of the multiplayer shooters are now letting you use a phone app or a website to adjust your loadout so that when you get home, you dive right into the game and, oh, cool, now I'm spec'd medic and I'm carrying this assault rifle and so on and so on. So it's letting you kind of take part of that experience with you, and that's really cool. You also get a lot more push. I think a lot of the – you see us a lot in the MTX guys, but I think there's actually some really interesting things to be done with time as a game mechanic. Now that we, you know, with more cloud-based stuff, more shared experiences, time where like, oh, this is going to take a day. Right now it seems living purely in free-to-play as a means for you to, well, spend money to speed it up. But other games, I think, have a huge potential to be aware of that kind of fourth-dimensional gameplay element and something that you know, is worth exploring.
Weren't you paying the EVE subscription just to keep your research going?
Oh, yeah.
Your 30-day research tasks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're not going to learn Marauders 5 just by farting around, man. You have to get in there.
You mentioned a word, cloud computing. I think that's not necessarily the persistent online stuff, but cloud computing power and what that can do to gaming. That's really interesting. So there might be some things that can happen in the future about that. But it's really hard when looking at the future of gaming. I think people can really only look 5 years out. It's too hard to go beyond that because you have no context about what's going to occur. So you can't recognize the opportunities out there that you could possibly use.
So without peeking too far behind the curtain, how can software, hardware, and business entrepreneurials work together to push the future of gaming?
Scratch
forward?
And sniff screens.
So, you know, Xbox, PC, Sony, people like EA, BioWare, and then Chris Bane.
As his own super entity.
Just Chris Bane? All by himself.
There's EA, there's Sony, there's Microsoft, and there's Chris Bane.
And there's Chris Bane.
Allow me to start. You know, I think what if the industry does a good job, you'll see a lot more freedom for experimentation, especially using interfaces and combining what you know cloud computing with your local gaming. And right now, the industry is, there seems to be that mentality of let's invest a ton right up front without knowing all the answers, and failures are treated very harshly. There's a lot of studios that when they try stuff, it doesn't work out. It impacts people's jobs, you know? And so I think if we can get to that point where, you know, the consumers out there and the fans are more willing to try more experimental stuff, and the studios themselves get a little softer about, you know, the failure on it, we'll break some eggs, and then we'll have some really interesting new gameplay patterns in the future.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when you look at, I'll call it camera-based entertainment, so everything from YouTube, television, movies. If you sort of group that into a big, put that under a single umbrella, and then compare that to gaming, there are a lot more things happening in that space from a monetization perspective, from a delivery perspective. You've got everything from I go to the theater and have an experience to I go on to the internet and spend 5 minutes watching something on YouTube for free that's driven by a little ad in the corner. So there's different monetization models, different delivery models. I think that's really where the future, in the sort of medium term, the gaming industry needs to really embrace that, is looking for different ways to monetize. Doesn't mean that existing monetization methods go away. It means that it broadens the hobby, it broadens the experience, because, I mean, movies, pretty much as a general rule, Hollywood movies always make money. They don't necessarily make money in the theater, but by the time everything happens, by the time they go international box office and then DVD and then they sell their syndication rights, they get a lot of opportunities to try to recoup their costs. Mm-hmm. We get one shot right now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there is a way for us to be like that, mm-hmm. but we need to be looking into that space. Mm.
It's an interesting topic about monetization, and the future of gaming has to still be financially successful, which means that you guys have to want to be engaged in it. So recognizing what those monetization options are is going to be really important. So,
well, and I think if we start to look at the trends we're seeing right now, there's a number of those that, and here's the thing, when you say monetization, it sounds like this evil, dirty thing.
Yeah. But people need to eat.
Yeah, it sounds like a, you know, a task-oriented, you know, money extraction device, like some sort of, you know, pneumatic tube you hook to your wallet, which is always horrible. But, like, if we look at, so say the life cycle a game can go through right now, and it's funny because the big studios were not really agile enough to quite have figured this out yet, but you see it in the small ones. You know, Kickstarter being a huge, huge thing. And essentially what Kickstarter is about, I think, is finding your really core audience. People who are so excited by your premise that they will give you money to help you realize that vision, right? That's impressive. You've got Greenlight, which is, again, saying, yes, this is a game that exists and we want to see it on Steam. You've now got those early alpha access games, like I've been playing Prison Architect recently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not done, and they're really open about that, but I was able to throw money at them in order to get access to the game, to have a chance to have developer feedback. Right there, again, you're finding your core, you're finding your really, really key people, and you're getting money to help finance it without having to necessarily go to a traditional publisher, which is awfully impressive. Now, the something like Inquisition, that's not going to work on Greenlight, right? Mm-hmm. It's a big game. It's a new engine. It's got all kinds of fancy hoo-ha. And that's good. That's good. It's good that we have this wide range. But between something like, you know, GOG resurrecting all these old game styles, which in turn I think actually helps revitalize the industry because suddenly people come along and go, God, I did love Theme Park Tycoon. Mm-hmm. You know, and why aren't there more of those? And then a friggin', you know, Kickstarter shows up and you're like, oh, yeah, I want more of those. So it's interesting how that's happening. And I think it's almost like we've hit some sort of awesome critical mass where there's enough impassioned gamers and there's enough distribution channels. Like, you know, look at Xbox saying, yeah, good, you'll be able to self-publish with the One. That's coming very soon. Obviously, Steam has been driving a big driving force on this. And just, heck, with websites, right? I mean, I remember buying Kentucky Route Zero directly from their website because I could, right? And I'm like, cool, then there's no cut off the top for you guys. I'm in. Then give me a Steam key. Awesome. Now it's convenient. Like, so we're seeing more and more exploration on that space in the smaller games. And as a result, I've been on an indie rampage recently. So
you're always on an indie rampage.
It's
you too.
Yeah. It's, well, when you're me, you can't be a hipster any other way.
But you've got the beard.
Yeah. Anyway, so what I'm saying is that the distribution channels, I think, are catching up to the point where you can find a core audience and fund a smaller game kind of on the core and not have to compromise it in any way without resorting to, like, you know, tricksy monetization. It's more just about how to turn it into income, how to reach your audience, and how to find your channel. So, you know, I'm hoping the future of gaming is this incredibly diverse spectrum where it's like, it, you know, good, I've got 10,000 people, but they are super willing to play this space game, so let's do this.
Yeah. I'd like to point out that Mike was not a hipster before it was cool. Yeah.
No, I wasn't even close.
Can you turn my mic?
I'll give you some skinny jeans.
Oh, Jesus, good God.
Yeah. You'll be good.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
No, just make sure they're... Oh, God. Yeah, just make sure they're tight enough you can tell what religion I am.
So I reckon... Oh, yeah, God. That's nice.
Now, yeah. There we go. Yeah.
So this is going to devolve into absolute chaos.
You started it, Cameron Lee. Okay.
So I reckon we're going to see more. Eventually, we'll see the industry open up into freedom of distribution. So both of you guys are talking about, like, lots of different channels, lots of different options. You know, you see similar things have happened to other businesses, and the few that are just trying to just stay onto, like, grasp into that control over their delivery are the ones that aren't that are struggling a little bit more. So I think eventually we're going to move there. I don't know when it's going to happen, but eventually someone's going to have to go, you know what, you want to play this game, play it here, play it there, whatever.
And also a little bit more freedom of choice as well. Like,
yeah,
I always think about as our industry matures and grandpas are playing with their grandchildren and there's more acceptance that games are just like books or TV or are a medium for us to experience things, that we will have Kickstarters and opportunities for people to make, let's say, because I used to be a teacher, educational things for people to buy or to use. There's just going to be more diversity, I think, for that. That
like the Jane McGonigal stuff.
Maybe we don't have to be in school, which would have been awesome when I was a kid.
Now so we're advocating no school?
I'm not advocating no school.
We have to have a meeting after the panel.
No, and there would be a difference between no school and no learning. So maybe we just broaden the classroom to include the whole world.
One thing I've been just thinking about in the past little while is... I think, you know, we're at the point where games are, they're exploring different price points, right? So again, yeah. Indies, right, there's some $10. You know, I've been playing Payday 2, and it's like, you know, $30, I think. So again, we've got this broader price point base. And I think one of the things that's been preying on my mind, as someone who makes a big game, right, you know, a big, big, huge game, is that it seems more and more like we're in competition for people's time than we are for their money, right? You know, like, distribution is very, very clean. There's so many potential distractions, you know, and you have every MMO in the world having all these, you know, daily quests and, you know, constant new PvP drops and all this stuff where you're like, that's, I mean, even for me, if I'm playing an MMO, I am playing less other games.
Right. Yeah, and I get home and I've made dinner and I put my toddler to bed. Then I got about 1 hour and I've got five games that I could play that I really want to play. And which one do I choose? It's hard.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, sometimes we see people pushing for features and going, well, how come you aren't doing this? Because I really want to play your game, but that's a feature that's super important to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried that spending that time without that feature will be a huge negative. So I have no idea how we're going to deal with that. I think it'll balance itself out, but just the volume of games available compared to, like, when I was a kid where it was like, wow, it's a new month. There's something else out on the Commodore 64.
Well, that's the nice thing about diversity is that I'd rather have diversity and too many games to choose from and maybe not play a couple that would have been really brilliant life changers rather than not have enough. And I think that'll just drive the quality up even higher. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing.
From a consumer standpoint, I know people are very driven by visual fidelity. And the question that always comes up is, what happens with that uncanny valley issue?
So I think you're starting to see some games, I think, start to push their way through the other side a little bit with some of their character art. That's an immensely expensive and dangerous thing, because I think the valley sits in a different place for every person. So when you look at something, you might think, oh, that looks amazing, and the person sitting next to you might think, oh, weird zombie person.
I think the Uncanny Valley moves as well, because I remember watching the original Lord of the Rings movie when I was a kid and actually being really creeped out by that movie simply because of the style that they chose for that. I found it really creepy and uncomfortable because I wasn't used to that kind of cartoon animation style. And I think as we get used to the Avatars movies and the, you know, fidelity in games, people get used to it and it starts to be okay a little more. And then you have the next leap, wherever that valley is.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that, you know, what gaming's proven right now is you know, we're at a point where the visual kind of fidelity is high enough that you can very deftly sidestep the uncanny valley, because I think, you know, the thing that you know, even we recognize with Dragon Age is that people don't necessarily want to look at, you know, photorealistic people on their screens. They want to look at people that feel like they're grounded in the world in which you're presenting them, right? So this is why everything Pixar does works so well. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Up, and everybody is a shape. Basically their head is a shape, and they're walking around, and, you know, the old guy's a square, right? And the thing is, there's a consistency across that in terms of the visual design. That makes you comfortable. You're at
it's
home
like
in this
elevator
space.
Elevator music. It's kind of non-interruptive.
It's non-interruptive, exactly. Or even you look at you know, what you can do with animation and expressiveness to evoke the emotion that's very human and very real. You know, something we've got a toddler. So Pokio, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but it's this awesome. Yeah, it's this awesome.
Our parents in the room.
Kids show. It's narrated by Stephen Fry, and it's about this little boy. But it's all done with like their eyes are literally like at signs, and yet it is one of the most expressive and convincing things, despite the fact they look like little plastic dolls.
Yeah, I mean the human brain has a tremendous capacity to pull faces and figures and emotion out of, you know, line drawings, right? You draw two circles and a notch and half a circle, and you've got a face, and it's instantly recognizable as a face. Mm-hmm. And you start adding eyebrows and you've got emotions, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the things that's really interesting for me as sort of the photorealistic angle sort of pushes off in one direction, seeing what people, you know, now that we have the technology, now that it's easier and easier to make games, what people are doing sort of on the other side of the curve, mm-hmm. with using that technology to do, you know, really interesting vector stuff. I mean, again, like Pixar, you know, animation is never going to go out of style. Mm-hmm. And because you can tell a story with characters that you can really get into.
And sound as well. Yeah. I think animation and sound are two fields that are under, I don't know what you say, not underappreciated, but under-celebrated, because the better they do their job, the more invisible they are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For instance, I know, your mom, I can't play The Last of Us because I watch this beginning, and there is one sound at the beginning about 10 minutes in where a little girl just goes, and I just put that down, and I don't think I can play that anymore. And if you've played the beginning, you'll know exactly which sound that is, because it's just heartbreaking. And so your audio departments and your animation departments, they just create that connection to the story and to what the characters are going through, and you make them, that stuff makes you care about those characters, which is important.
Yeah, the visual fidelity is a really interesting topic, and we hear it a lot, and we have to think about it a lot in what we do, but there's two things that trump it in my mind all the time. One is fun, right? Is it fun or not? Are you actually going to enjoy playing this thing, or is it just because, oh my God, it's so real, right? That's not going to make me want to play the game. And the other one is, I don't care if this box here is the highest fidelity box you've ever seen in your entire life, but I do care that the whole frame of imagery around you is immersive and pulls you in and it's detailed and it feels like I want to be a part of this world, that's far more important, I think, to players and to us than a 5 million poly box.
It's like reading a novel. Like I just read Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman, and it is one of those books that I came back. It was just this weekend. I came back and I had an hour before dinner, and I was like, oh, I'm just going to read this for 5 minutes and then have a nap. And I read the whole thing, and I didn't actually realize I'd read the whole thing until the last page. It just pulled me into that space so well. It's the same thing.
I do think that's actually exactly what we're going to see, is that level, that immersion, the things that bring that. So consistency of world design, whether that be, you know, grass that moves when you walk through it, or just more motion in the frame, just more of what you expect to see, whether it's stylized or realistic, just more a consistent experience where the characters aren't walking essentially on a soundstage, where the set becomes something as well.
It scrolls behind them like a Looney Tunes kind of.
I mean, look at Minecraft. It's the least high fidelity experience you'll play this year,
but
it is entirely consistent.
Yeah.
And then you look at the clock and it's 3 a.m. and what happened?
Yeah, it's the theory of flow, right? That essentially is, if nothing is knocking you out of that space where you're in a game and you're thinking about a game and you're in the game and you're living the game, and if you look at the amount of work like Firaxis, as a shining example, puts into making sure that their UIs are very consistent, the information you need to effectively upgrade your civilization or send your XCOM soldiers out is all very clean and takes you from step to step, and there's always like two or three things just bubbling, right? It's like pots just bubbling there waiting for you to, oh, that one's done, cool, but one more is a day away, I'll click, right? And that's how they get you, right? And the visuals, I think, as long as they aren't knocking you out of that immersive state, they can be literally of any design. I mean, you look at something like another good example of their Minecraft is like the emotional journey to the moon takes you on. It's this almost 8-bit old school pixel art, but by the time you're done that, if you're not reaching for the whiskey bottle, you've done something wrong.
So my last question before I open it up to audience: 5,000 years in the future.
So after we've recovered from the monkey apocalypse,
okay. Liara Tassoni excavating. Joy of my heart. She finds a copy of Dragon Age Inquisition, able to play it on whatever emulators happening at the time. Of course, gaming is still around because gaming, if any of you are archaeologically minded, has always been around in some form or another. What do future archaeologists think about Dragon Age Inquisition?
He wants to take that one.
What do the people in the future think of Dragon Age Inquisition?
Wow. That's a really
good question. Are you mad at us, Jessica? What's going
on? You said this was the panel, Mark, because I told you to move on yesterday, right?
Why did I come up?
Yeah. Sorry, Chris Bain.
So, I mean, ideally, for me, this is an archaeologist who at least has studied, games of the time, is familiar with what's happening, and they're able to look at it and go, they can compare it to kind of its peers and go, okay, cool, I see that this is kind of an evolution, not like a revolution, because I think fundamentally the game we're trying to make is one that captures a real hardcore RPG essence, right? We were going back full TACAM and having the party control and all those things that are kind of part of this legacy, and then looking at the visuals and the immersion behind it, right? So that my hope is that they can see that they would be able to put it in a context, right? It's place in the metafiction essentially, and that they understand that it's kind of us trying to update a classic gaming style, and not to do so in opposition to other games that are exploring that same top-down space or what have you. But they're trying to do that. And then ideally that they, that there's an understanding that the story behind it, right, the story of the Inquisitor and the story of trying to uncover what's happening is, if anything, a study of human nature, of how humans, and I think we all to some degree suffer from this, are flawed, you know, in that sometimes we're lost in our own universe, and you know, we're all the hero of our own story. So we seize opportunities when perhaps the longer scale, you know, thing to do might be more altruistic but more harmful to us in the short term. And I think that, you know, whether it's security, whether it's, you know, global climate, whether it's, you know, there's so many things facing us right now, and we're so deluged with information that I think we might kind of be on the cusp of understanding that you know, being self-absorbed is not something that's sustainable. Mm. And that if the Dragon Age, you know, I guess franchise does anything, is that it recognizes that humans have this weakness, but that we don't all have to have this weakness. That you can rise above, and you can, you know, kind of set aside the self, and with the support of those around you, right? That's why party and friendship is such a huge part of the game. That you can work together to affect some kind of change, right? And that while it's a dark world, it's ultimately a hopeful message. And I think those are kind of the elements that we see as kind of integral to Dragon Age. And whether it's a dragon landing on your workers, or a sturdy door in a thing, that all those conflicts are actually part of serving this larger thing. That teamwork, friendship, and altruism can rise above, you know, a world that otherwise would be profoundly fucked.
That's really pretty, Mike.
Wow. Yeah, that was very serious.
I also think probably Liara would be in love with Varric. Like she is with the Protheans, because he's pretty lovable.
I hope that they play it and then get very confused and think that all the people that lived 5,000 years ago had big horns like the playable canary. And then, I know, it starts a new fashion with like prosthetic horns. That's my goal.
Shepherd, they appear to have worshipped small rabbit things with human hands. Maybe they were their gods.
I'm telling Ellie Hillis.
Go ahead.
Or Lainey.
I think one interesting thing, too, that you don't even have to go too far in the future, is to see how far it's come along. And, you know, you see a four-year-old with, you know, with a tablet. They've never lived in a world where you couldn't press a button, ask for permission first, and get content. And, you know, you think back, well, you know, when we were kids, it's like, new game, you know, you'd have to save up, you'd have to, you know, beg, you'd have to go to the store, and like not really, not a form of punishment, but there was a lot of work that kind of went into it. And it's, you look back and you're like, wow, that was kind of hard. And just even one generation later, it's a completely different experience when you think of the whole of acquiring games and playing them and going through it. And, you know, Liara, I mean, she'd probably look at it and be like, how come this isn't in my head? Like, Why do I have to use a controller?
It is in her head because in it's synthesis, so it's 5,000 years in the future. It's after synthesis has happened.
So. Could we maybe not go there right now? Because I already heard the warning sounds. Can you hear that?
Well, I realized after I asked the question, I was like, shit. If anyone's asking, I was like, oh no, 2180. Or whatever. I don't want someone to be like, fake it, girl.
Wow.
I'll choke them out for you, Jessica.
My timeline was incorrect in the question, so. Uh-oh.
And none of us
okay,
caught it.
Okay, so questions.
No one caught
let's
it.
Move on.
Let's go. Right, let's on. Take it questions. To the floor.
But I'm no, Chris. This. Chris, you were right. Just don't. Good answer.
Oh. Good morning, ladies and gents. My question to you is actually in interactive storytelling. There are lots of really interesting mechanics and technologies that are used for implementing really interesting gameplay. So what either technological or gameplay mechanics have you encountered that you would like to see more of in the future, or that you're sad are gone?
Smell-o-vision. No kidding.
One thing that... that I think that has weirdly disappeared, though I think it's starting to make a comeback, is the procedurally generated content, which doesn't work. It doesn't work on a pure story like this narrative is like, hi there, Jim,
we're the blah. We'd like you to blah. Like at that point, you're like, oh, wow, I can see through that. I mean, the old Freelancer. I don't know if anyone played Freelancer, but that was how you got all your missions. We have an interest in this place. Okay, yes. Thank you for your canned lines. So looking at like, look at the huge resurgence of roguelikes, right? Like it's like, half the people don't know what rogue is, but they sure know roguelike, which is great. It's procedural. It's not repetitive. It's got lots of elements of randomness to it, and your success is in part determined by your ability to kind of observe the patterns over time. And I think that where there's a huge opportunity is to say, well, you know, could there be kind of a core story that's kind of advanced, kind of like more the Privateer model, to stick with my spaceflight sim nerdetry, where in Privateer, you know, you were constantly being told like, well, you know, you're going to need to get a ship powerful enough to fly to, you know, the whatever nebula. And the game didn't care how you did that, right? It simply did that. It simply set that as an objective for you, and away you went. You can see that same thing happening in the most recent XCOM, which had far more narrative than the original, but I think still kept the spirit of the original, in that, you know, Dr. Valen would come along, you know, bitch at you for using explosives, but then say, so get me a prisoner. Right. And as a player, you were like, cool, I'm going to go get a prisoner. How do I do that? And then you start looking at how you do that. And suddenly you're researching a new weapon. You're building a new facility for your base. You're likely building a reactor to power that facility. Then you're equipping a guy with the weapon. And then you're sending that guy out who's ballsy enough to get within 3 squares to capture one of the enemies. And you have to do all that quickly enough that you aren't fighting like the mutants by the time you manage to pull it off. So when you think about how many game systems are involved in that task, and that, you know, the enemy positions and stuff are randomly generated, what you have is a narrative that's waiting for you to engage with its randomness to the point where you've then crested sort of a goal. And once you've done so, awesome, the narrative may now proceed, right? And that's part of the things that, well, you know, I love the original XCOM, having those beats where they're like, we've discovered something. I'm like, ooh, you know, like it was nice to have that extra bit of story as kind of my candy to draw me forward. So I thought that was very powerful. And that element of randomness is something that I think we lost for a number of years. And it's just started to come back in the past, say, 5. And it's really awesome for me to see it return.
I think an interesting piece of technology we may start to see in the next couple of years is probably in sort of the indie space, is games that can recognize the player's emotion and react to that. I'm not sure that we'll see that a lot in the AAA space, because I'm not sure that we want that to be the game. But I think you'll see games that are just about that. Like, you know, you could imagine the police detective sim, where it's entirely takes place inside of the interview room, and you play the role of either the police detective or the criminal, and then the game is essentially reacting to you because it's watching your reaction, basically trying to figure out if you are lying, the player.
So L.A. Noire with Kinect, basically?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd play that.
Yeah, I actually, that was my favorite part, L.A. Noire, right?
So I think we may start to see that. I think that's an interesting piece of technology, that it's probably right on the verge. Let's say people are hard, so everyone always thinks that we're on the cusp of what was Molyneux's dude?
Milo.
Like, we're always a year away from Milo, but I think we're going to be a year away from Milo for a lot of years now. Right. So
I sure hope we stay a year away from Milo. That thing was weirding me out.
I have a couple of questions. One related to Dragon Age development in general.
We should probably stick it to one question. Right. So pick your favorite one question.
All right. For Origins, you had the death magic, in which you had a passive that react to the number of dead people around you.
Mm-hmm.
How do you guys feel about the dynamic toggles and stuff like that, and just spells that you turn on, and it doesn't just stop with turning it on, and it continues to react to the environment?
I think they're rad.
I think they're rad, too.
Yeah. I mean, they add a timeliness, and they add a degree of, you know, essentially anytime you say to the player, you know, Thou shalt engage with forethought, right? You end up with a really cool game dynamic, because especially if there's a cost to those things. So in Origins, they ate part of your mana bar,
right, or a stamina bar if they maintained, then suddenly you were making one of the Sid Meier-esque series of interesting choices you could make, right? Well, will I do it or will I not? So those are always very powerful in my mind. I love them.
So recently, or not recently, maybe so much as, I think it's about casual gamers and the people who aren't so interested in hardcore fights and stuff have been getting more and more into gaming. And this, you know, sort of came around with mobile gaming and such, and Facebook games as well, but they have been branching out into less combat-focused games sometimes. And also, I know that BioWare has actually managed to be one of the main sort of AAA attractors of these casual gamers because of your focus on story and characters. And of course, this causes a lot of tension in the community because you sort of have two main groups of people that are really attracted to your games: the people who really want the old school RPG story-driven narrative, and then the people who just want the story. They're just looking for a good story. And I'm wondering how you see this conflict both being handled in your current games, especially Dragon Age Origins, but also Inquisition. I just woke up. I haven't had coffee yet. Dragon Age Inquisitions, but also in the future, how you see this developing both for the casual gamers and also for your games.
Ooh, I'll take this.
Yep.
So it's actually a lot more complicated than that. In a perfect world, when you started a game, you would do a 15-minute psychological test, and we would use the results of that test to determine how you played the game, how you want to play the game. Because if you look at a game like Dragon Age, there's a lot of things like, okay, do I want to play tactically? Do I want to play the combat, and I want it to be hard, but I actually want to play in direct control of a single character? How much story do I want to see? How much choice do I want? Do I want incidental choice? Do I want not to have incidental choice?
Yeah.
Do I want the AI to solve that for me? Like, there's just a lot of things, all of which color and shape and twist the game. So what we ultimately will be trying to do is try to figure out how to allow you the control to play the game the way that you want to play it. If you want to play the game mostly for the story, then we'll try to give you the tools to do that. Ultimately, the combat's not going to go away, but we'll try to give you the tools to do that. If you want to play the game more in more direct control of a single character, we'll try to give you the tools to do that. If you want to play the game like an old school Dragon Age Origins, top down, tactical, balls hard, we want to give you the tools to do that as well. And the idea of a difficulty slider is a bit of it's not that it's outlived its usefulness, but it's not enough. Mm-hmm. It's not enough mm-hmm. complexity mm-hmm. in terms of what the actual problem set represents.
Yeah. We need an experience matrix.
Mark's, I think, spot on. You know, it's one of the premises that we have, you know, for Inquisition is that it's your game, as Mark said, right? So play it how you want to play it. And then it comes down to, because we need to have as much depth in there to handle a full-on RPG, right, which is what we all want to make. And so you can almost think about it like a funnel sort of thing. So when people come in the top, you don't want to have barriers that are going to kick out the people who are interested in mostly story and things like that. You know, you don't want combat to always look really just, oh my God, how do I get through all these stats and what do I do? You know, so different people are going to enjoy it for different reasons. So we have to try and find a way where we don't put barriers in place, but we don't remove the depth of the funnel. And I think through those different choices and tools that Mark's talking about, that's how you get that, because they can engage as much as they, or as little as they like with the different parts of it. So I think that's... And then the other thing with casual gamers and that sort of uprising is that casual gamers don't always just stay as casual gamers. Some, a lot of them do, but often a lot also evolve into other sorts of gamers.
I don't really like so the word casual gamers.
Yeah, neither do I, actually.
Yeah, it's just a new, different gamer, you know, like... So you'll see them move around. So,
well, I think there's also a difference between, you know, like people playing on mobile games, and I think you look at games like Telltale's game and Gone Home, where it's more about interactive storytelling and problem solving or adventuring, and there's little combat. There's no interactive combat at all. And so, we're keenly aware of what's going on in the market, and you know, we love it when people you know, experiment with new ways of telling a story, because everything's evolving, and it'll be interesting to see, because, you know, I don't know if you saw the mobile game up earlier. It's like you can't really do narrative that way, but it doesn't mean that you can't have a different way to tell a narrative. Mm-hmm. So it's it'll be interesting to see how it evolves over the next little while.
Yeah, or different difficulty within the narrative, like make persuades, make the ability to make persuades harder, or puzzles harder. Like I in my department, I work with somebody who doesn't enjoy combat. She is pretty sensitive about violence, and doesn't enjoy it. But she's a pretty good problem solver and would rather up the slider on the Tower of Hanoi difficulty. Mm-hmm. That's how she sees herself. She sees herself maybe as a casual violence or combat player, but she sees herself as a hardcore mastermind puzzle player. That's what she likes.
Yeah, I think you know, from fundamental, the, you know, the game we make will be the game we make, right? And you know, if we end up at the point where you know, part of our audience is like, look, I've just had it with your fighting, right? Mm-hmm. You know, say that's a pretty extreme example, but I hate your fighting, I don't want it. I think that at this point, you know, there's a point at which you have to say, well, you know, is this the right game for you, right? Because the fighting is part of it, right? It is, mm-hmm. it is part of the experience, and you know, telling us that we should remove all the fighting and get rid of it forever because that's not the game I want it seems increasingly self-absorbed in a world where there are lots and lots and lots of games mm-hmm. coming out and many, many more in development right now that have literally no fighting, right? Mm-hmm. That's cool.
But there is a limit and a line. I mean, we already have countries with laws about different kinds. I mean, mm-hmm. France has very strict laws on child labor, and Germany has very strict laws about violence and what you can do with, say, dead bodies or mm. decapitations in games. We just don't have them because we can't sell our game in that country if we have those in our game. So we have slightly different versions yep. sometimes across the industry for whatever's in your game for those regions. You're right. You don't want to go all the way down that rabbit hole. But it is a consideration where yep. there's sometimes a history in a country or a history of something that a group of people doesn't really actually want to see.
Yeah.
You're not going to get rid of fighting, and you're not going to get rid of your story as well.
Yeah, well, the game essentially needs to have a locus point, right? Like a central point where the game exists. And we will give you lots of options around that point. But, you know, if it's ultimately, we are trying to make a game that is an RPG, right? Mm-hmm. There are stats, there are numbers, there is loot, there is equipment, there are monsters, there is stuff for you to fight, there are choices for you to make. Right, and if you know, we can give you some degree of spread around that point, but if it's like, I don't want games with any choice in them, well, okay, cool. I have some amazing recommendations. Yeah. But essentially it's like, you know, there can be a point at which, you know, it is your game and you will be able to play it the way you want to, but that's always within a set of confines.
Yeah,
because if we try to pander to everybody, it turns into like this gray goop.
You can choose from the stars in that constellation, but it's still in the southern hemisphere.
Wow. Nice.
Thank you.
Very poetic.
I also had We Put the Fun in Funnel ready, but I never used
Ooh.
It.
Oh. Oh. I like that.
Wow.
New Byway,
Mel.
Mel.
We also put the gnoll in Funnel.
Well, now that Mel has entered question time with a pun, I wonder if there's anything that you guys would like to actually end our panel on.
Kind of like We Put the Fun in Funnel.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the future of gaming ends on Fun and Funnel.
Come on, think of something pithy there, Mark.
Mark, Mike?
The one thing I don't feel we did is we didn't actually define the time frame for future, so I'd like to point out that if you get at a small enough time scale, it's now.
The future is now?
Now.
Yep.
The contemporary future?
Now.
Enter Spaceball quote here.
Yeah.
Nice.
Oh, for those of you who are listening to this in the podcast, the future is here. It is just not evenly distributed.
Are we on a podcast?
Yeah.
Have we been doing podcasts for all of the
years? Yes.
What the hell?
Wow.
So that time
I've been swearing my head off and like talking crap
for
3 days.
Yeah. For now.
And that time when you took your pants off.
Yep.
All right.
On the internet.
Yep.
Right.
Fernando Melo is going to be listening to this, and he's going to shame you later in the office.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well,
Thank you, everyone, for listening
especially
to this.
Thank you to Chris Bain.
Chris Bain.
All right. Well, next time.
And that brings us to the end of this episode's BioWare-based panel coverage. We hope you enjoyed listening.
Thank you so much. You can find us on Twitter, @NerdAppropriate, or Facebook, /NerdAppropriate. Email us directly. That is Matt, Hillary with one L, Scott, or Ash at NerdAppropriate.com. And we have over 100 episodes to check out. So definitely subscribe and let us know what you think. Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone.